operator. I have concerns about how the drone community operates.
The U.S. has to explain what went wrong.
Drones have not caused a huge number of civilian casualties.
We've seen them make mistakes by the hundreds.
The rescuers would come in, and the CIA was coming back and bombing again.
I believe the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war.
It's just point and click.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming. I must say this documentary really shook me. It was incredibly chilling, extremely informative, and raises a lot of serious questions about the morality of drone warfare. And Tim, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I think it's really good. It's a very kind of polished presentation of a lot of the arguments around drone warfare, which manages to cram a lot into quite a brief running time. In fact, it's only about an hour and 15 minutes long. But I particularly valued the range of perspectives in it, because you get an awful lot of them. You get the kind of military perspective from a kind of critiquing position. You get the industrial perspective from a kind of constructor. You get the perspective of an actual drone operator. You get the ground level perspective of victims, particularly in Waziristan, where the CIA has been kind of most guilty of kind of really pushing the drone operation to its limit. And yes, the survivors and the families of victims are especially moving in that respect. And the overall kind of mosaic that's built up is quite damning, I think, and well put together in the edit.
I was going to say, there's a whole range of different people interviewed in this documentary that makes it really rich. And Dan, as someone who's familiar on this subject of drone warfare, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I thought it was very good, and it really highlighted how what was once the kind of ultimate dystopian fantasy of the future, basically people being hunted by robots, is now a reality in places like Waziristan. And it really shows the juxtaposition between, as we saw there, the operatives who are, as far as they're concerned, playing a video game in the US and Virginia or wherever it is, and then the lives of people in Waziristan. And you know, there's this juxtaposition between this super high levels of technology, the most kind of advanced technology available to mankind, being visited upon one of the most underdeveloped regions on the planet. After seeing the film, I looked up some of the human development statistics for Waziristan, mm-hmm. and it's shocking, less than 20% of the houses there have running water. More than a third lack electricity. There's one doctor per 1,000. Infant mortality is nearly 1 in 10. And yet the pretty much the only technology the rich world decides to send to these places is this industrial killing machine. And so that juxtaposition was really brought home. And you also saw the juxtaposition between the operatives who are often basically recruited literally as children, and barely children through the video game industry, which they point out.
Actually, I want to talk about the video game industry a bit later on. It's a good point, but I just want to briefly talk now, just before we go to our next clip, about the nature of drones. There's a quick and easy death. Could you explain exactly how they work?
Well, they're a combination of three things, I suppose, aren't they? A camera, an airplane, and a missile. And so the operative is controlling them remotely. There's no pilot on board. And they find their target, which, as they said, they don't actually see in great depth because the drones are very high. They can't see their faces. And this is part of what the film brings out very well, is the depersonalization of killing to make it easier to kill. As mentioned on the trailer, you never see their faces. And it shows later in the film about how they try to show the humanity to the operatives of the people they're killing by actually.
And that's actually a good point, because it leads us right to our next clip, actually.
Right.
We're going to see Brandon Wright now, who's a former drone operator.
And I watched this man bleed out. The missile had taken it off one of his legs right above the knee. And I watched him bleed out of his femoral artery. And he's rolling on the ground. And I imagined his last moments. I didn't know what to feel. I just knew that I had ended something that I had no right to end. But I swore an oath, did what I was supposed to do. I followed through with it. It was like my image of myself was cracking and breaking apart. And the safety observer laughs and he slaps me on the back and he says, "You should have seen how you jumped when I said splash." And he's laughing like it's the biggest joke in the world.
That was truly harrowing and sadistic, that. I mean, so that was Brandon Bryant, a former drone operator turned American whistleblower. Now, Tim, we can tell from the documentary, even though he's done some terrible things, he comes across as genuinely remorseful, and you can't help but feel sorry for him. Do you think this was an intentional part on behalf of the filmmaker?
Oh, yeah, very much so. He's one of the most sympathetic interviewees, and his testimony is really quite powerful. It helps that he's so photogenic. His sort of... if you like, his turning, the change of his mind and opinion about it reminded me of the way that it's been dramatized for feature films, actually. There's a film called Good Kill with Ethan Hawke playing a very similar figure who is an operator who really kind of suffers this sudden crisis of conscience. And I think it's very well put across, actually. And he's very articulate at it in his kind of quiet way. And it's important that people like him are stepping forward to make the point, in fact, that, you know, the real cost morally is to them, not to their superiors, not to the people telling them what to do, but to the actual people clicking the button, if you like. And the idea of being kind of instructed, for instance, to perform one of the so-called double tap strikes, where, you know, you drop a bomb and then people come in to try and help the wounded and the victims, and you drop another bomb in the same site. The idea of being a person who's actually having to physically click the button, send in death to a bunch of completely innocent civilians who are just simply on the scene to help, would really haunt you for the rest of your life, I think. And that's the feeling we get from this guy.
Yeah, we get that sense of the psychological impact it has on the former drone operators. And Dan, in the documentary, it seems as though they were duped into the job. You could tell he was conflicted. And can you explain more on that?
Well, yeah, he talks about one... in fact, it's interesting you say about him kind of turning, but in fact, he says right from the start, before he pressed a button on anyone, about having this feeling like he didn't think he'd be able to kill anyone. And he tells his superior, and his superior tells him, "Well, sorry, but you signed the oath, you have to."
And so surely it must be okay then.
Right. Well,
it's cognitive dissonance then.
Exactly. Partly it must be okay, but I think more than that, he doesn't see a way out. And he talks about not being allowed to see a therapist because that he reduces his security clearance. Goes to see a chaplain. The chaplain says it's part of God's plan. Basically, it's fine. So he's in doubt about it from the start. But it really shows, like I was saying before, they're kind of recruited as children playing video games, and then they literally start doing it still as teenagers. Often, the other drone operative there, the interview started when he was 19, I think. I'm not sure when this guy started, but it really shows, I think, the kind of institutionalized child abuse, really, in both the US and Waziristan. They're killing children. They've targeted 16-year-olds before. Maybe they've targeted younger children. Way younger children have been killed as innocent bystanders. But the children in the US who they're recruiting and getting to do this stuff are permanently damaged. Well, they're permanently damaged if they have any empathy. Mm-hmm. But obviously, part of drone warfare is to try and get rid of empathy on the side of the operatives as well.
I think it desensitizes them in a lot of sense as well. And I think, Tim, one of the major issues also in this documentary is the video game industry and its relationship with the military. Could you explain to us a bit more about that in the film?
Yeah, this is a significant kind of subplot, if you like. And they talk about how, instead of recruiting meatheads these days, there's one person interviewed who says that, in fact, they're now looking for the geeks. You know, basically, the kids who are really good at these war games, the Tom Clancy Ghost Recon type war games, there's this sort of weird conference that you can see set up where they're all kind of testing out these games, and the military is sort of crawling around trying to find who the most skillful players are, because that's going to be the next generation of operators and recruits. It's not a new thing for the military to exploit extremely young soldiers. I mean, look at Vietnam, look at the ages of kids being sent into Vietnam, for instance. But it's certainly a new technology that's enabling it to happen from a whole world away, and to happen in a way that is very veiled and controlled, so that the moral question is removed from the equation.
Mm-hmm. So then it's essentially glamorizing and normalizing warfare in the form of video games. It's a really fascinating subject.
War is an unbelievably profitable business. The development of robotic warfare, and particularly drones, is having a huge impact on the trade in arms generally, because it's causing the big defense contractors to rethink their business models and how they're going to sell enough drones to be able to make the sorts of profits that they're making on the big ticket, very expensive items, aircraft carriers, jet fighters, etc. So I think what that is going to do is ensure that we see produced far more drones that even your very hawkish security analyst would think that the world needs. And these companies are huge. And you only have a few of them in every country, closely linked to their governments.
Well, it's funny to think that, which the documentary mentions, that drones were originally invented to help fishermen find tuna fish. And you wouldn't think that, but of course that wasn't profitable, so they weaponized them. So Tim, what are your thoughts on this? Is this a worrisome endeavor, the prospect of drones and as business?
Well, absolutely. I mean, as any kind of business concern tied to warfare would disturb you, this does. I think for me the single most disturbing implication of the film is the idea that terrorism is providing an excuse for the US military to develop this technology and for someone uses the phrase the terrorist industrial complex. The idea that, you know, if they're out there, we've got to keep doing this stuff, we've got to keep building it, we've got to keep getting better and better at killing people. And warfare becomes a permanent state rather than one that you declare and then you declare over. It becomes a permanent state because at any point you can click and send in death to anywhere in the world. That is extremely disturbing, I think. And the film brings it up quite smartly. I could have watched another whole film on that topic, actually, that much broader topic.
Yeah. And what were your thoughts on the advancement of military technology and drones as a business?
Yeah, it's very worrying, and it's I agree with Tim that it's setting the stage for permanent war, not just permanent war, but also war without geographical boundaries. The whole world is a battlefield in the global war on terror. So they opened, I think, right at the start of the film. They say, well, U.S. is not at war with Pakistan, mm-hmm. and yet it's sending out these bomber planes.
I wanted to ask you actually, because mm-hmm. it does mention that. But why is the U.S. at war with Pakistan then?
Well, I mean, I think what is missing from the film, this isn't necessarily a criticism, because I don't think it's not trying necessarily to explain the politics of it so much as present just a picture of what's happening.
Presenting the facts, right.
Right, but the politics are slightly absent, and I think the politics of it are that so it comes across very disturbing, but at the same time, I think we should be aware that really this is not a sign of U.S. omnipotence. Far from it. It's actually a sign of desperation, because the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were so costly in terms of blood and treasure, and blood to their own side, that basically Colin Powell said in 2006 the U.S. Army is broken. It meant the resistance to those wars meant they could not continue. They could basically ruled out the prospect of any similar mass occupation by U.S. forces. So what we've seen as a response to that is this new type of warfare, which has got two elements. Part of it is drone warfare, and part of it is proxy wars, where you're recruiting mm-hmm. local militia to basically do the fighting in place of U.S. soldiers. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what's driving it, I think. I don't think it's all about the profits of the military and so on. It's
Tim,
strategic.
Would you have liked to see that in the film? Thanks, Dan, for the explanation. But would you have liked to see more context?
Especially about Waziristan, I think, because it's such a sort of strange theatre for them to have encroached into, and the attacks there are much more prolific than anywhere else. So we see the kind of suffering, but we don't have any sense of the motive. It's very peculiar. And that was a problem for me. I mean, a lot of the kind of deaths and the damage there were obviously collateral, and there are civilian deaths, no matter how much, you know, the U.S. government would like to not deny that those are happening in large quantities. And there's an interesting kind of contradiction in terms of the technology developing, I think, because the more sophisticated and targeted it can become, with any luck, you would find fewer of those civilian casualties. So there's this peculiar thing. The film does raise that point slightly, and I found that an interesting kind of counter argument, if you like. Mm-hmm. I thought it was an interesting wrinkle in the thesis, because yes, the more targeted they get, if drone warfare is going to be allowed to remain legal, well, that is in fact preferable than just the kind of blanket bombing approach.
Well, I think that's slightly
right. Apology there, gentlemen. Sorry, we'll continue this in the next part of the discussion, as we're going to fast forward towards the end of the film now.
The United States has become a national security state whose raison d'etre is war. We've created a terrorist industrial complex that is self-perpetuating, and now searching for the reason for this constant state of war, terrorism is the perfect case for us. We can do this forever.
It just feels like we're going through like a bad science fiction novel. If we dehumanize war, if we take the human aspect out of it, what's to stop us from just sending a bunch of automaton robots into another country and let them wipe out the entire population? People were writing about this in like the early 1900s. What could happen? And we're watching it happen.
Tim, would you agree with that statement? Is that one of the main messages that this film leaves you with?
Yeah, the desensitization of violence and warfare is, again, one of the most unsettling aspects of this. And the idea that you're not in combat face-to-face, you're in combat halfway around the globe. And I do think that the attempts to bring a kind of moral or understanding to those involved, and this is, they do things like trying to put big posters of children's faces over the top of buildings in Waziristan, so that the operators, you know, with the drone cameras, will have to see their target before they press the button, will have to make that decision. But you suspect that the US military will still find people that they can kind of bully into pressing the button, and that's the really disturbing thing. And the kind of psychological cost on those soldiers, if you like, must be extraordinary. And how they are, the legality of it is another question. And another very interesting point raised by a legal professor at the end is, you know, even if through some kind of loophole, the CIA is allowing, is kind of making the argument that this is in fact legal war, the question is, should it be? The question is, do we want that to be declared legal? So, you know, it's not enough to say, yes, this is technically legal. You have to sort of say, well, should it be?
Well, Dan, sorry. Sorry, were you going to say more?
Dan,
would you agree? But President Obama, though, says that drones saves lives and kills lots of terrorists in one go. How accurate is that claim?
Well, I would say two things. It's not accurate. We know there have been hundreds of... I think why I was going to say it as a red herring a little bit, to say that there's... to make this distinction between who's targeted and who's the bystander. On the one hand, there have been huge numbers of bystanders killed. They're not that targeted. They had footage from one drone strike that killed 44 people. I've read a study that suggests 8% only of the victims of drone strikes have been actual known al-Qaeda operatives. But I think even that making that distinction is false. The most interesting point I thought made by anyone on the film was a Pakistani lawyer, Shahzad Akbar, who says, Westerners always ask me the same thing. How many civilians have been killed in these strikes? He said, my answer is, they're all civilians. He says, no one's ever proved that they're militants. They've never been on trial. There's been no evidence presented. And I think this really illustrates what lies behind, as you say, they'll always find people willing to press the button. Now, why is that? What's driving this more than any military-industrial complex is racism. It really shows the relevance, I think, of Frantz Fanon's concept of a zone of non-being. Basically, since the conquest of the Americas, the Europeans have treated non-Europeans as less than human. And places like Waziristan, you don't have to respect the rule of law, you don't have to respect due process. And as the lawyer says, people in Waziristan seem to be treated guilty until proven innocent.
And so that is a powerful message that leaves you, that you can take that interpretation. But Tim, what message does this documentary leave you with in 30 seconds or so?
Yeah, it's this kind of the lack of geographical boundaries and the kind of... the idea of being watched, if you're declared an enemy of the US government, the state of total paranoia that you would live in, knowing that these things are flying over your heads, it makes that very clear. There's a very good image as well of the Waziristan children with catapults trying to shoot up into the sky. It was a brilliant David versus Goliath image of their impotence in the face of this really all-pervasive threat.
Yeah, and how helpless they are. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
the bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The best chance that many South Africans have to get vaccinated anytime soon is to volunteer for a clinical trial and test unproven coronavirus vaccines on their bodies. But that arrangement has raised ethical questions. First is whether countries like South Africa, which is supporting trials by four drug makers, should be guaranteed doses if the trials succeed. The government hasn't received such a guarantee. At any rate, such an arrangement would be ethically murky, since it would punish countries that participate in unsuccessful trials. We now present you an article written jointly by Matt Apuzzo and Selam Gebrekidan. The piece is titled, For COVID-19 Vaccines, Some Are Too Rich and Too Poor. The article was published by the New York Times. Stay with us for more of Matt Apuzzo and Selam Gebrekidan's article. A few months from now, a factory in South Africa is expected to begin churning out 1 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine each day in the African country hardest hit by the pandemic. But those vials will probably be shipped to a distribution center in Europe and then rushed to Western countries that have pre-ordered them by the hundreds of millions. None have been set aside for South Africa itself. The country, which will help manufacture the vaccine and whose citizens have enrolled in clinical trials, does not expect to see the first trickle of doses until around the middle of next year. By then, the United States, Britain and Canada may already have vaccinated more than 100 million people. The first year of the COVID-19 pandemic revealed that a country's wealth would not spare it from the virus. Overconfidence, poor planning and ignored warnings felled some of the world's richest nations. But now, money is translating into undeniable advantages. Over the past few months, rich nations like the United States and Britain have cut deals with multiple drug manufacturers and secured enough doses to vaccinate their citizens multiple times over. China and Russia have conducted their own trials and begun mass vaccination programs. Yet countries like South Africa are in a singular bind because they cannot hold out hope for charity. Although its government is nearly insolvent and half of its citizens live in poverty, South Africa is considered too rich to qualify for cut-rate vaccines from international aid organizations. Salim Abdulkarim, an epidemiologist who leads the country's Coronavirus Advisory Council, said, "Where you're not rich enough, but you're not poor enough, you're stuck." Poor and middle-income nations, largely unable to compete in the open market, rely on a complex vaccine-sharing scheme called COVAX. A collaboration of international health organizations, COVAX was designed to avoid the inequities of a free market free-for-all. But its deals come with strings attached, and health advocates are questioning its transparency and accountability. By the middle of next year, South African officials hope to secure their first vaccine doses under the COVAX program, even as they negotiate to buy supplemental supplies from drug manufacturers. But in a country where luxury estates are walled off from sprawling squatter villages, many expect the newest vaccines to remain a privilege for residents who can pay out of pocket or through supplemental insurance, a program that disproportionately benefits white people. The best chance that many South Africans have to get vaccinated anytime soon is to volunteer for a clinical trial and test unproven vaccines on their bodies. But the arrangement has raised ethical questions. First is whether countries like South Africa, which is supporting trials by four drug makers, should be guaranteed doses of vaccines if the trials succeed. The government hasn't received such a guarantee, and at any rate, such an arrangement would be ethically murky, because it would punish countries that participate in unsuccessful trials. In the 1990s, when antiretroviral drugs to treat HIV were developed, South Africans volunteered for clinical trials, knowing that they could never afford the medicine otherwise. Dr. Venter said, "If you had money, you were able to buy it. If you didn't, you died." He added, "It's going to be the same thing again." COVAX was set up to prevent that. It came together with money and support from the World Health Organization, WHO, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, and Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. Countries, even those that cannot hope to compete on the open market, can buy into COVAX and receive vaccines. Poor countries pay nothing. South African medical advisers say the COVAX system is vital but also deeply frustrating. Governments must pay up front without knowing what vaccine they will receive or getting any guarantees on when the doses will arrive. COVAX estimates the price per dose but offers little recourse if the cost is ultimately much higher. Countries must assume all of the risk if the vaccine fails or if anything goes wrong. During a recent call with reporters, COVAX officials called their vaccine sharing program the only global solution to this pandemic. Seth Berkley, the chief executive of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, said, "We still need more doses, and yes, we still need more money, but we have a clear pathway to securing the initial 2 billion doses of vaccine and then beyond that." Still, Seth Berkley and other officials declined to reveal their arrangements with drug companies, describing them as company secrets. They also did not make public the deals they have struck with individual countries. Fatima Hassan, a human rights lawyer, said, "They're agreeing to buy something with public money, and we won't have any influence on pricing." Fatima Hassan added, "COVAX is saying the pricing is fair, but we don't know. Where's the transparency?" Those trade-offs might be palatable for countries receiving the medicine nearly free, but South Africa is paying about $140 million for its COVAX doses to vaccinate roughly 10% of its population, including healthcare workers and some high-risk people. The South African government hopes to cover the country's remaining 50 million people through private deals with drug companies. Globally, the process is secretive, with governments not disclosing the prices that they are paying for vaccines. When a Belgian minister recently published the European Union's price list, she revealed that prices vary depending on who's doing the buying. Many South Africans are deeply skeptical of pharmaceutical companies and wary of government corruption. The health minister, Zweli Mkhize, said in a recent call with reporters that it was essential that rich countries not hoard vaccines, but otherwise the government has said little about its plans. Outraged, health advocates have threatened to sue the country's government to make the plans public. Ultimately, though, money is the great differentiator. From the outset, South Africa's government knew it could not afford to order doses before they were tested and approved, as wealthy countries did. South Africa has seen this play out before, Back in 2009, when the world feared a devastating H1N1 flu outbreak, rich countries hoarded the earliest vaccines. While the outbreak was far weaker than expected, it revealed the inequities that exist when countries compete for life-saving medicine. For the COVID-19 vaccine, government officials and advisors say they have met with or received preliminary inquiries from most of the major pharmaceutical companies. Abdul Karim, the head of the country's coronavirus council, said the country needed to be judicious in choosing a vaccine that best fits the needs of South Africans. For example, rushing to buy the Pfizer vaccine, which requires shipping and storage at ultra-cold temperatures, made no sense at all when cheaper, simpler, and more manageable medicines were on the horizon. But because South Africa did not pre-order doses from private companies, the country may have to watch its own domestic drug makers, Aspen Pharmacare, produce vaccines for other countries before they are available domestically. Under contract with Johnson & Johnson, the South African drug maker Aspen is expected to produce millions of vaccine doses. South African officials have high hopes for the vaccine, which does not need cold storage and promises to require one injection rather than two. Ms. Hassan said, "We'll participate in your trials, we'll manufacture your vaccines, but we don't know if we'll get access." Johnson & Johnson has promised to sell its vaccines at break-even prices and provide 500 million doses to COVAX to help poor countries. Aspen's chief executive, Stephen Saad, said he was proud of that commitment, but he acknowledged that there is no guarantee for South Africa. Stephen Saad said, "It's Johnson & Johnson's decision as to where the product goes." South Africa, which has now passed 1 million COVID-19 cases, is facing its second wave. Public health officials are particularly worried about a new mutation of coronavirus that they believe may have made the virus more contagious. In poor and working-class neighborhoods, the greater fear is for a new lockdown. The government's earlier lockdown devastated the economy and confined many South Africans to tin shacks built on arm's length apart, with a dozen families sharing an outhouse and many more sharing a water tap. Ms. Van Madoda, who was selected for a drug trial, said, "It's impossible to have social distancing here in South Africa." He's counting on the vaccine, hoping he got the actual medicine and not a placebo. He said, "I want my life back." Ms. Van Madoda woke up the day after his injection feeling well. He talked it over with his wife, and they decided that she would walk to Dr. Gill's clinic and enroll that weekend. A few days later, though, Dr. Gill got word that Johnson & Johnson did not need any new test subjects at her location. Data was pouring in, a good outcome, but that meant that when people began lining up at the gates early that morning, she had to turn them away.
Debate. Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip have held their first joint military drills since the year 2014. They held the drill to unveil their military capabilities and equipment. Now, the immediate question that arises is, why are they holding the drills at this time? Is there something in the works, or is it simply a show of force, resistance, and preparation against their enemy, Israel? In this edition of the debate, we will zoom in on these two questions and find out from our guests where the situation may end up.
In an incident considered the first of its kind in the Gaza Strip, the joint chamber of the Palestinian resistance factions held its first larger-scale joint military drill over the past years. During the one-day military exercise, Palestinian groups unveiled some of their military capabilities and equipment.
The Palestinian resistance groups showed their unity in this joint military exercise. The drill is aimed at showing the improvement of the resistance capabilities. It sends this message to the Israeli enemy that we are capable of facing any aggression against the Gaza Strip.
The drill consisted of simulation of ground and air military operations, during which several rockets were fired toward the sea.
We believe that the unity of all Palestinian groups is the only way to improve our strength and capabilities in order to face the Israeli regime. It shows how strong we have become in our struggle against the occupation.
Today, the resistance groups sent a strong message to the Israeli army that the Palestinian resistance is capable of defending Palestinians against any aggression. It also showed how united they are in their resistance.
Since 2008, Israel has waged three wars against Gaza, where 2 million Palestinians live under a 12-year Israeli blockade from air, sea, and land. Thousands of Gazans have been killed in each of these deadly wars. The Palestinian resistance groups say they hold the drills to show their military capabilities as well as unity in fight against the Israeli aggression. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, we have Moti Abu Musabe, who's a Palestinian political activist, joining us from Gaza City. And we also have Khalid Barakat, who's a journalist and activist, joining us from Vancouver. I'd like to welcome you both. Moti Abu Musabe, let me first start with you and ask you a straightforward question. Why the Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip are holding their first joint military drill, something that hasn't happened since the year 2014, the first of its kind in the Gaza Strip?
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me here once again. And actually, if we want to talk about this military drill implemented by the Palestinian military factions here in the Gaza Strip, I think we need to focus and shed the light on the messages that the Palestinian factions wanted to send to different parties, actually, at the same time. And I think the first one and the most important message was directed to the Israeli occupation and the Israeli leaders, especially in these political conditions and the political deadlocks that those leaders are experiencing on the Israeli arena. We all realize and we all know that the Israeli leaders used to maneuver and evade their internal political deadlocks and the crisis by attacking the Palestinian territories in order to export those political deadlocks and the crisis. So the clear message for the Israeli leaders was that the Palestinian resistance factions are well prepared to confront and to resist any Israeli aggression and offense against the population of the Gaza Strip. The clear message also was that the Palestinian resistance would never allow for the Israeli leaders to invest and to exploit and to use the Palestinian blood as a winning card to achieve their political aims at the expense of the Palestinian people. So I think that the message was clear to the Israeli occupation that the situation here is nowadays is different, and any decision and making such a decision of attacking Gaza is different from any other precedent decisions today. Any attack and any offense against Gaza Strip would never be a picnic for the Israeli soldiers. This, I think, was the first one. Secondly, I think that the Palestinian resistance factions through this military drill reminded the whole world and the international community that is still turning a blind eye to the Israeli ongoing perpetual crimes against the Palestinian people. Okay. That the Palestinians have the mere right to defend themselves against that Israeli crime.
Right. Okay, very well. Let's move on to Khalid Barakat. Khalid Barakat, so our guest was zooming in amongst many points that he made about the reaction that Israel is going to have on this. We're looking at 12 Palestinian armed groups that actually held these drills, firing rockets into the Mediterranean, launching drones in the airspace. We saw rockets being fired, and of course the footage there is testament to the depth of what was executed. Do you think that, well, what message will that send to Israel, in your opinion, and do you think that that would change Israel's calculations when they, and if they want to attack Gaza, as they have done so many times, including obviously the three major wars?
Yes, I think that the message is that the Palestinian resistance is sending to Israel and other parties as well, is that the internal Palestinian front in Gaza is united, and the Palestinian resistance factions and forces are united in confronting any Israeli aggression. Let's remember that these Palestinian military drills and exercises comes at the anniversary of the massacre that took place in 2008 when Israel launched a full-scale aggression against the people in Gaza in 2008, what they called CASLED, and it resulted in killing more than 1,400 Palestinians, the destruction of thousands of houses, killing more than 430 Palestinian children, even the destruction of some of UN facilities, hospitals, mosques, and so on and so forth. So this message to Israel is that we, Palestinian resistance, are ready and alert, and they will respond against any Israeli aggression. Let's remember that also in that time, Obama was getting ready to be in the White House, very similar situation to what we see today with Biden, and Israel used deception at that time in order to launch a sudden attack against people in Gaza. The first day of that aggression resulted in the killing of more than 200 Palestinians. And so the resistance wants to send a message that we are alert, we are united, and at the same time, it is a message to the normalization camp and the defeated camp in the region that Gaza, despite the siege that it's been placed under for more than 12 years now, the capabilities of the Palestinian resistance is not, you know, you cannot compare it to 2008. Today, they're united, they're strong, and the not just the Palestinian resistance, but resisting camp in the region as well are united and alert.
Okay, so Moti, let's look at another outcome out of this one-day drill that has come out, and that is that obviously, aside from the unity that is shown amongst these Palestinian factions, we're also looking at how they have said that perhaps this lack of Palestinian reconciliation and the normalization of relations with Israel by some Arab countries is another message that this sends out. Do you agree with that?
Yes, actually, beside what your guest has mentioned, and beside what was mentioned by throughout the report, I think the message was clear that despite, especially in these hard circumstances and this hard time that the Palestinians and the Palestinian cause is experiencing, and actually we all are witnessing the cruel attempts of the surrounding Arab regimes to liquidate the Palestinian cause and end the Palestinian rights nowadays. So I think the timing of this drill is key and important, that despite all those shameful and disgraceful agreements that aims to liquidate the Palestinian cause in favor of the Israeli occupation, in return for some investments here or there, and actually the message was clear that despite all of that, Palestinians would never allow to relinquish their rights to drop their weapons or to raise the white flag. Yes, those normalization agreements constituted a stab in the back of the Palestinian people and abandoned the Palestinian people alone in front of the criminal Israeli occupation. But the Palestinians, despite all of that, would never drop their weapon and would never surrender for the Israeli occupation. I think this is a clear message in this time exactly. The second message is, was that despite the failure of the reconciliation negotiation between the Palestinian faction, the real unity translated on the ground and expressed by the was expressed by the such a military drill, which constituted a clear and has delivered a clear message that the real unity is in the field and the Palestinian military, and there is a wide consensus among the Palestinians that the resistance choice is the mere choice for them to regain their rights and to have their rights again, okay, of living in dignity and freedom.
Okay, Khaled Barakat, this comes at a time when recently, a day or two ago, we had the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah, Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah, that said that Israel had threatened to hit one of its facilities, and the Secretary General said that, if you do that, we have, first of all, twice as many precision-guided missiles as a year ago, and we have the capability with these missiles to hit all of Palestine and all of Israel, the occupied territories. Then you have the Palestinian factions that executed this one-day military exercise, which is very large-scale and one of its kind. So we can see that the resistance front is very strong. Is there a connection here? And also, again, if I was Israel and I'm looking at these events, I would think twice about any military adventurism that perhaps they might want to do or go ahead with.
Absolutely. And we see that the unity of the resistance camp in the region is more strong today than any other time in the last 10 years. The coordination and the level of cooperation between the resistance in Lebanon and the Palestinian resistance, with the support of Iran and Syria, and the popular support, the wide popular support that the resistance enjoy. We see that the Palestinian people across the board, whether in Palestine or in exile and diaspora, looks at the Palestinian resistance and the Lebanese resistance as a one front. And we see the vast popular support that these exercises are getting. Now, the challenge really is the political challenge, the internal political challenges, whether in Lebanon or in Palestine, and more importantly, the political front. We see that the weak link in Palestine is the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. This is a force, a reactionary force that is now trying to send messages to the Biden administration that they're ready to go back to negotiations and security cooperation with Israel. Today in Palestine, we see these two camps very clearly, the camp of resistance and the camp of, the Palestinian Authority and security cooperation. So in Lebanon, the interview, the comprehensive interview that General Secretary of Hezbollah, Said Hassan Nasrallah, gave the interview of the year, he pointed out that the capabilities of the resistance in Lebanon in the last since 2006 battle until today, we see that how the capabilities is absolutely mounted and is more strong than before. Also, in a few days, it will be the anniversary of the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani, and the crime that the United States have committed against Iran and Iraq by assassinating a general who played a central role in supporting both the Lebanese and the Palestinian resistance. So it is, in a way, a message to the enemy, but at the same time, it is a message of solidarity and unity.
Okay, since you've touched on that there, Khaled Barakat, I'm going to ask our guest there from Gaza City. You know, we are looking at this one-year anniversary, and Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was very symbolic for the Palestinians who looked at his martyrdom and the way that he was assassinated very deeply, that he was somebody who sacrificed his life for the for Palestine, for Jerusalem al-Quds, and obviously supported the Palestinian resistance. We're looking again at this, the focus of our debate, which is this one-day military exercise. And you know, there's lots of notions that there's going to be retaliation that may occur as a result. Do you think, therefore, that there is a connection here, that this anniversary is coming up, and you have this one-day military exercise that happened in the Gaza Strip? Mut Abu Masada.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Actually, there is a strong connection between these two topics, and this there is a clear message that the Palestinians realize the role that Qasem Soleimani has played in supporting the Palestinian resistance here in the Gaza Strip, and we cannot neglect or ignore such a role that the martyr Qasem Soleimani has played. It has played in supporting the Palestinian resistance. Yes, the clear message, I think that despite all the cruel attempts and despite all the attacks and all the clampdown against the resistance pivot here in the region, that the resistance the resistance fronts, either it was in Palestine, in Gaza, or in Lebanon, or in any other place, is still strong against the Israeli occupation and the United States.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that. We're going to end it there. Let me thank our guest. You were just listening to Moti Abu Musaba, Palestinian political activist there from Gaza City, and Khaled Barakat, a pleasure to have you, journalists and activists from Vancouver. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitali, the entire team here in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.